very radiance and energy that is talking to me through this thing. In purely empirical terms, it's called participation. But it's more than that. It's identification. You know, the Hindus ask, who am I? Asking this is a big discipline. Am I this body? I was once giving a lecture to a group of prep school boys on Buddhism, and I wondered, how could I render this idea to them? Because what is called the Buddha consciousness is the one consciousness of which we are all manifestations. We are all Buddha things. We are all separate manifestations of this great consciousness that informs the whole universe. The plants are conscious, the stones are conscious, all things are conscious. So I said to the boys, look at the ceiling. You can say the lights, plural, are on, or you can say the light is on. There are two ways of saying exactly the same thing. The lights are on is accenting the individual vehicle, the bulb, and the light is on is accenting the general light. But they are two ways of saying exactly the same thing. Now, in Japan, the accent on the individual thing is called the jihoke, or the individual realm, and the accent on the general is called the rihoke, the general realm. And there's a little saying, jirimuga, individual, general, no obstruction, no difference. So when one light breaks, the superintendent of buildings and grounds doesn't come in and say, oh, I was particularly fond of that bulb, that was the important one, this is a calamity. He takes it out, puts another bulb in. What is important? Is it the light or the vehicle? They are the vehicles of consciousness. So which are you? Are you the head or are you the consciousness? With what do you identify yourself? With the vehicle or with what is carried? And if you can identify yourself with what is carried, namely consciousness, that's the consciousness that's in all the bulbs. And so you are identifying yourself with that which is the unifying principle, and that's what the person identifies himself with who goes to save another person spontaneously. These are two approaches to the realization that the separateness is secondary, and the separateness is a function of the experience within time and space. When I was a kid walking through the woods, I'd come every now and then, as everyone will, to a barbed wire fence. And the barbed wire that runs alongside it and leans right up against a tree so that the tree will have enclosed it. The tree took the barbed wire into account. Or you cut yourself and the white corpuscles come. You can interpret these things mechanically, or you can interpret them in terms of actual will.
Tarnas. The Christian tradition, compared to the Buddhist tradition, seems to lack a certain understanding of mythic symbols. Now I'm wondering whether that would be true only of Orthodox institutional Christianity, and whether there's, in Christianity itself, some sort of core of mythic understanding that is just as valid as in Hinduism or Buddhism.
The problem here is that in Hinduism or Buddhism, the historical interpretation of the symbols, the reference to the life of the Buddha, is quite secondary. The accent in Hinduism and Buddhism is the relevance of the symbolic forms to your own life. You understand these references inward to yourself. For instance, most of the Buddhas had no historical existence at all. Nobody thinks they ever had. To the Chinese, Guan Jin, or to the Japanese, Canon, the great bodhisattva of inexhaustible compassion, is a purely mythic figure but represents something. Whereas in the Christian traditions, the accent is on the historical understanding of the terms, of the images. If you say to a Christian, Jesus did not resurrect from the dead physically, did not ascend to heaven, that's a challenge to what he regards as important in his faith. With the Jews, if you begin to question the whole thing of the Exodus and Moses going on the mountain, coming back with the law and then breaking it and going back for a second edition, if you express doubts about all this, this is a direct hit. The importance for the Hindu would be not what happened 2,000 or 3,000 years ago somewhere else, but what's happening to you now. What is the symbol doing to you now? Now, since both Judaism and Christianity are mythologically structured orders of symbol, they are susceptible to the other kind of reading. And that comes breaking through every now and then with a prophet or mystic when he suddenly sees the symbol as saying something totally different. And it's something that has to do with an immediate attitude of you to life. For instance, with the crucifixion, if you think of this as a calamity that is the result of your sins and Adam's sins and all that, that Jesus had to come down, the Son of the Father, give himself up on the cross for death and look sad there, that's one reading. But you can read it another way, as the zeal of eternity for incarnation in time, which involves the breaking up of the one into the many, and the acceptance of the sufferings of the will as part of the organic delights, the wisdom sheath and rapture, the bliss. He is in bliss. St. Augustine says this somewhere, where he says, Jesus went to the cross as the bridegroom to the bride. That's a total transformation of the idea. Another one, the idea of the end of time. The end of time as a historical event, that's nonsense, and what does it matter? The importance of the end of time is as a psychological event. Then you have to render it and experience it that way. When you have seen the radiance of eternity through all the forms of time, and it's a function of art to make that visible to you, then you have really ended life in the world as it is lived by those who think only in the historical terms. This is the function of mythology. That's a mythological reading of what was otherwise a theological statement.
Tarnas. So in some ways, the Christian institutional religion has erred on the side of historical concretism?
Radically.
Tarnas. And it's just built into the side of the religion.
Well, right now, in competition with all the gurus and Rinpoches and Roshis who are coming over here, the Christians are beginning to think, yeah, perhaps not sociology and just helping the poor, but find the divine within yourself and living not you but Christ in you. We need the Orient to teach us about the aspect of personal experience in religion. The Christ idea and the Buddha idea are perfectly equivalent mythological symbols. Two ways of saying the same thing, that a transcendent energy consciousness informs the whole world and informs you. To become aware of that, and to live out of that center instead of out of this mind center, is the salvation of your life. That means putting yourself in accord with nature. That means also that you must understand nature to be harmonious. Whereas in our biblical tradition with the fall, a good God created a good world, then a diabolical intruder broke it up so that nature is corrupt. Then you have to distinguish this and distinguish that. You can't yield to nature that way and say, this is where I'm going to have to yield. All of their codes of right and wrong, sin and atonement, that whole, I don't know what lies behind the institutional insistence upon that. I think of it very often as, well, remember the old Listerine ad where it would say, even your best friend won't tell you, but you have bad breath, and the way to rescue yourself is to buy Listerine? What the church tells you, even your best friend won't tell you, but you are in sin, and we've got the medicine for you right here. And when you've got an invisible cure for an invisible disease, you've got something you can sell.
Brown. Why have we in the West lost this sense of what you are calling accord with nature?
We're getting back to a kind of Lamarckian view. Lamarck was earlier than Darwin, and of Goethe. Goethe had a theory of evolution, and Schopenhauer has a wonderful paper called The Will in Nature, where he speaks about these things.
Favreau. So you think at the protoplasmic level there is some intention?
There has to be. I saw a film of my friend Stanley Kellerman, made at the University of Pennsylvania, I think, of just raw protoplasm under a microscope. And you see this acts as a flow, and then there's a flow this way, and pretty soon the flow is building a little channel for itself. It's building a house for itself. When I drove down here to Esalen from San Francisco after that film, all I could see as I drove was protoplasm. Protoplasm in the form of cows eating, protoplasm in the form of grass, protoplasm overhead. It was a kind of satori, a kind of revelation. The whole world as intentional protoplasm with consciousness and energy. From then I come to the feeling of energy and consciousness being two aspects of the same thing.
Favreau, the physicists are saying that nowadays.
I know they are. I got a wonderful letter from a biologist from Harvard, a professor emeritus, an old, old man. He sent me a paper that he had read at one of the international congresses, and he said, "It shocks my scientific consciousness, but I have to conclude that there is an intention in nature." Mythologies are, in fact, the public dreams that move and shape societies. And conversely, one's own dreams are the little myths of the private gods, anti-gods, and guardian powers that are moving and shaping oneself. Revelations of the actual fears, desires, aims, and values by which one's life is subliminally ordered.
Joseph Campbell, The Mythic Image. Brown. But doesn't that run against his grain? He just comes spiritually to that sense because the physical theories don't allow that kind of thinking.
One of the great things about a good scientist is, whether it runs against his grain or not, he speaks out what he finds as evidence. That's a thing that most religious people don't do. They stick with their religious thoughts, and no amount of evidence will dislodge them. But the scientific attitude is, we haven't found truth. We have found a working hypothesis that explains a new fact. We may have to change the whole thing. It's in. People don't understand this about science. Now, I'm interested in the biological thing because I think of mythology as a function of biology. Let's say that every organ of the body has its energy impulse, an impulse to action, and the experience of the conflicts of these different energies inside is what constitutes the psyche. It's nature talking, and mythology is the expression in personified images of these energies.
Brown, how can we channel these energies into our daily lives?
That's what we're talking about, the relationship of mythology and mythological studies to contemporary lives. My point is that I'd actually seen it work in inspiring art careers. Mythology puts you down in that level out of which the imagination functions, and it comes out of the imagination. A mythological image that has to be explained to the brain is not working. When you move through a culture field that is so alien to your own that the images don't click off any response, any recognition, then you're out of sync. This is one of the problems with our tradition, with our inherited mythology. Let's say the Judeo-Christian tradition that relates to the Near East in the very first millennium BC. It has nothing to do with life here. Everything has to be explained. Washed in the blood of the lamb. So what does that mean if you've never even seen a lamb?
Gilliman. In cultural distinctions, I can just envisage that when we think of the mythology of Medea and Jason and her brewing this soup to rejuvenate the old man and her searching for the Nepenthe in her witch's soup. Eventually, when I isolated the first of the endorphins, you may say that this was the ultimate crystallization of such an idea.
Witch's brew!
Gilliman, yes. Even though I honestly cannot say that it was the story of Medea and Jason that led me to look for the endorphin in the brain. Kennard, when you were researching, did you think these mythological thoughts? Gilliman, when you were involved in isolating, characterizing one of these molecules from the brain, you don't have much time to think of Medea and Jason.
I should think not.
Kennard, my tradition is Judeo-Christian, and I'm so far from the Near East. Your tradition, Jamaka, is much closer to you. What difference does that make? Highwater, it makes a great deal of difference. When Joseph Campbell was talking about the washing in the blood of the lamb, I was thinking of the funny fact that, to the Inuit, the Eskimo people, it's inconceivable that this terrible place that bad people apparently go from our culture is hot. Their afterworld is generally very cold and dismal. Now, is that just a matter of setting the thermostat differently? I don't think so. I think it has a basic kind of human poetry. And I don't think poetry is limited to artists. As I understand it, Einstein was not a great scientist, he was a great poet. He was capable, The scientists or technologists later proved what he intuited, but largely what he did was not anything remotely like 19th century science, and that is why I think he's such a master of 20th century science. Kennard, aren't scientists always telling art what to do? Aren't scientists always accused of having no mythology?
Well, these are two totally different perspectives. The problem of science is to give you an image of the universe, what it's like, what it actually is like. And this changes from decade to decade. No scientist says, "I've found truth." There's a working hypothesis, and the next season we have another structure.
Gieleman. I would qualify that. Enormously. Enormously.
Okay, they think they've found truth. So the problem of mythology is to relate that found truth to the actual living of a life. Mythology has to do with how you live your life. There's a famous line at the close of Goethe's Faust, "Everything phenomenal or temporal is but a reference, but a metaphor." And then Nietzsche topped that a few years later by saying, "Everything eternal is but a reference, but a metaphor." Now the function of mythology is to help us to experience everything temporal as a reference, and also to experience the so-called eternal verities as merely references. Mythology opens the world so that it becomes transparent to something that is beyond speech, beyond words, in short, what we call transcendence. Without that, you don't have a mythology. Any system of thinking, ideologies of one kind or another, that does not open to transcendence cannot be classified or understood mythologically. The first function of mythology, then, is to function by showing everything as a metaphor to transcendence. The first field that has to be transcendentalized this way is the field of the environment that we're in, the world that we live in, so that we can see the whole world as opening to a dimension of wonder and mystery. Every object in the world speaks of this mystery, the mystery of life, and consciousness pours in through the various bodies and beings round about. It must then show you yourself that you are similarly transparent to transcendence. And finally, in a mythologically organized society, all of the rituals are organized in such a way that they help you to experience yourself, the world, and the social order of which you are a part in this mystical way. And of what I regard as four major functions that mythology serves, the first one is the mystical function. The second is the cosmological, relating to the cosmos. The third is the sociological. And the fourth is the pedagogical, carrying the individual through the stages of his life. The myth guides you through the rituals, initiation rites, fertility rites, puberty rites, funeral rites. These are for guiding the individual through the inevitable course of a lifetime, and the human lifetime in this matter has not changed since the time of the Aurignacian caves. The mystical function is opening the transcendence, opening the heart and mind, pointing out that the ultimate mystery that we all try to solve lies beyond the range of human thought or naming. When you have given it a name and a thought, you have fallen short. You're no longer in the mystical tradition. For instance, in Judaism, where God is named and he tells you what's good and what's right, these are the fire words and reduces mythology to ethics. There are moments of reverence, of what I call worship, where one gets an experience that seems to correspond to something named in the scriptures, but this isn't mysticism. Mysticism actually goes beyond this whole field of separation, I and thou, and when a deity says, "I am it," he becomes a roadblock. As they used to say in the second and third centuries, the problem with Yahweh is that he thinks he's God. The final reference has to go past the God. The God has to be transparent and transcendent. And the word transcendent is the key word to mythology. All of these figures are flickering, just as we are ourselves in the field. In a mythology such as the American Indian tribes, the whole world is understood that way. The animals give themselves, the body animal gives himself as a willing victim to participate in this game of, "Now you eat me." And with the knowledge that the life energy survives death, is transcendent of the temporal experience, the belief is that the animal will come back and you can relate to it properly next year. Am I not right here?
Highwater. Even to a further extent, which I think is the hardest thing for a Western people to understand, in that in most tribes there is not an individual goal. The Iroquois word for it is orenda, the tribal soul. From the Native American standpoint, it is an energy, it is a power, and it exists in rock, it exists in dogs and cats, and it exists in you and me. It flickers in us for a moment, but we do have a classic way of making it burn bright or hardly burn at all.
Yes, yes. Well, that's the first of four. There's a second function I call cosmological, and that is in the world as the science of the day presents it, or as the knowledge of the day presents itself, radiant of this transcendent energy. Turn the whole world into an icon so that it's radiant. And that's the function of art, to take the world so it is radiant. That's the aha in art. That's the aesthetic arrest when the object is presented in such a way you don't ask the artist, what does this mean? If he wants to insult you, he'll tell you. The thing has to come through and hit you with an aha.
High water. Or the painting will ask you, what do you mean? Guilleman. What you've described in terms of a community soul where there is no specific individuality is in some ways exactly the description of what modern science is. Science belongs to everybody. And no subject, no discovery is really the work of a single individual. That's saying, in other words, what you're saying about the individuality of the soul. That it is more the tribal soul or community or people, which is exactly what science says. The contribution with my name is infinitesimal. Add to that more contributions in the name of other people, and eventually you have the movement of modern science. High water. Art, which seems so transient, so unimportant, seems to be the most transcendent of human creative activity. Whereas science seems to be the most revisional, seems to need to criticize itself in order to move forward, and in fact reverses itself. I can't think of any scientist in the last 10 or 20 years who hasn't actually said just that. Guilleman. That's how science progresses, in contradistinction to philosophy, which appears to want to remain or to keep what it had at one time. Science gives us an image of the world, but that's the second step. I would like to get a difference between believing and looking at an image and knowing that the structure of a molecule in 2,000 years will still be the same. That truth is a truth, which, by the way, existed years ago, but we did not uncover it. Molecules existed long before the observer was born. This is the uncovering rather than the discovering of science.
Audience, you can't separate the observer from the observed. That's what modern science seems to be getting into. That's the way you make mythology and you make science, by saying that the process is all ultimately the same.
High water. When I hear you use the word mythology, it's a little bit like hearing someone use the word wilderness when they look at nature. And I try to say there's nothing wild about it. And I think you think of mythology as a kind of faction, and science as a kind of a fact.
What I'm trying to say is that the structuring of a mythology is conditioned by the science at that time. There's no use in constructing a mythology based on an archaic science. I wouldn't know what to do with an atom, but I do recognize that when we had a Ptolemaic cosmology, there was a whole interpretation of the relationship of the Earth to the different planes of the universe that was mythologized. What happened to that was it was given an ethical and moral value. The stages of a ladder of the heavens represented the stages of the psyche. Well, anyhow, the myth has to deal with the cosmology of today, and it's no good when it's based on a mythology or a cosmology that's out of date, and that's one of our problems. I don't see any conflict between science and religion. Religion has to accept the science of the day and penetrate it to the mystery. The conflict is between the science of 2000 BC and the science of AD 2000.
High water. Isn't it possible that the very pursuit of the scientist is a mythological form itself?
The quest is a vision quest. It is the scientist's enactment of the vision quest that everybody's engaged in. How do you find the truth of your own being and relate to it? Isn't that true?
High water. What is fundamental to all this apparent diversity?
Exactly so.
High water. That's a mythological process, isn't it? Yet I think that the word myth is so completely confused with the word falsehood that we come to it with a very inadequate emotional response.
Now we've come to the sociological function of mythology. All mythologies have had, among other functions, that of validating and maintaining a certain specific social system. The moral system is culturally established, and it will be very different when you move from here to there. And we find in all basic mythologies that the whole world is a manifestation, an emanation, as the god itself comes into being, as a personification of certain of those energies. He's not an external thing at all. Then the fourth function of mythology, and this is the one where you suddenly feel the lack of myth today, is the pedagogical, the guiding of individuals in a harmonious way through the inevitable crises of a lifetime. That's the main one. Linking the individual to his society so he feels an organic part of it. The individual is carried by the myth in a very deep, participatory way into the society, and then the society disengages him. And so what happens to all his energy? It has to go down deep into himself, and that is the mystical part, the interrelation to the life cause. First, induction of the individual into the society, then disengagement of him and the carriage of him through mystical meditations and the understanding of the symbols to the seat of his own life within himself. Now, what is the seat of life? I remember a very pretty little book by Edwin Schrödinger where I believe he uses the ultimate terms Brahman or Atman. Here's a fundamental modern scientist who ultimately, when he comes to speak about the relationship of the individual to it all, has to use these words that are not of our crystallized tradition where God is there and man is here, and this is the good society and all the others are junk. And when you look at the cosmos, is the mystery behind that cosmos interested in just these people being in that place or in getting them there to the other side somehow? It's a fantastic story we have.
Brown, how do you explain the severe fundamentalist religious movements around the world these days?
What you have there is the result of the concretization of the symbols. To think that this symbolic statement refers to a historical fact. And the two prime ones that are troubling our world are the image of the virgin birth, which has nothing to do with a biological problem, and the image of the promised land, which has nothing to do with real estate. These are symbols of the birth in the heart of the spiritual life, in contrast to a biological one where all the values of the biological life suddenly move into a secondary position, and one is moving then along a spiritual trajectory. And the goal of that spiritual trajectory is the relationship of the individual to the land and the world of harmony. And that is the promised land. It has to do with what you're doing inside yourself, not whom you've got your weapons pointed at to kill. The shift is dramatic. And so you can say that history is simply a function of misunderstood mythology.
Cockrell, what system of images would be the best window to an experience of the transcendent?
I find that when I read either an Upanishadic text or one or another of the Buddhist sutras, that does it. Those traditions were, and still are, traditions that are really centered in transcendence. They realize that all phenomenology of life is a shadow display of powers that are not fully given in the display. I find that the main result for me in my endeavors has been the confirmation of a thought that I have long and faithfully entertained, of the unity of the race of man, not only in biology, but also in its spiritual history, which has everywhere unfolded in the manner of a single symphony, with its many themes announced, developed, amplified, and turned about, distorted, reasserted, and today, in a grand fortissimo of all sections sounding together, irresistibly advancing to some kind of mighty climax out of which the next great movement will emerge. And I can see no reason why anyone should suppose that, in the future, the same motifs already heard will not be sounding still, in new relationships indeed, but ever the same motifs.
Joseph Campbell, The Masks of God.
There are energies that move in our body. No one knows whence. They come from something transcending our consciousness. We can't even conceive them. And those energies that come in the subatomic particle displays, you know, they come and go, come and go. Life is throwing up these forms, these forms, these forms. Then our consciousness becomes interested in something else there, or gets some ethical idea that is contrary to nature. Mythological images are transparent to transcendence. Every mythic image points past itself. Every deity opens to mystery. You know, the kingdom of the Father is spread upon the earth, and men do not see it. Well, you have to open up to that seeing.
Cockerell, what is unique about those traditions that they've been able to continue to be translucent while our traditions have become opaque?
Our traditions haven't become opaque. They started by being opaque. And it comes from the fact that the mythic figures are read not as poetically inspired, but as prose. And when you read mythology as prose and apply it to the aggrandizement of your particular group or society, you're off the trail. This is what I would call pathological mythology. The whole idea of a chosen people, for example, is pathology. Every people is a chosen people. The realization that you're being chosen does not distinguish you from anybody else, but tells you what it is about everybody else that is wonderful, that, like yourself, they are of a mysterious transcending ground. All beings are Buddha beings. Now, we don't know more than one or two or three names associated with the sages, the hearers who delivered the Upanishads. But this starts already back in the 9th and 10th centuries B.C. They realized that the whole phenomenology of the world is a projection of a mystery ground. And that mystery ground is the ground of your own being. You are that mystery which you are seeking to know. But it's not the you that you fancy. It's not the aspect that your friends are enjoying, that thing in the phenomenal world that is moving around. It is that ground of being that was there, will be there, is what you are to refer to. One might say that the function of a ritual and of a mythology is to put the conscious mind, which is in touch only with the phenomenology of the world, in touch with the ground of those phenomena, particularly of your own action, so that you act not as an ego, but as a carrier of a process that is transcendent in its course. When a myth links you, for example, to your society, it's linking you to something bigger than yourself, but it's not big enough. The society itself must be seen as linked to something bigger than that, which is the world of the environment. If you get stuck with that, that's not big enough either. That has to become transparent. Carl Fried Graf Durkheim's word, become transparent to transcendence, is the key to the whole thing. That's a key word. And as soon as a myth is read as a fact, you lose the transparency and it becomes an aberration and a deluding guide. One of the problems that's going on now is with the enormous accent on sociology rather than biology. It hit me when I read of the Russian biologist Vavilov, whose biology differed from Lysenko, who was standing for the idea that society can shape nature. It can't. That man was sent out to Siberia. Nobody even knows when he died, one of the great biologists of the century. But his point of view differed from Stalin's. And I find also in our colleges that the accent that has gone into sociology, 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 sociology in interpreting how one should live is distracting because our sociology is far away from the biological ground. Economics is what controls us. Economics and politics are the governing powers of life today, and that's why everything is screwy. You have to get back in accord with nature, and that's what these myths are all about. Now, in the 19th century, sociological anthropologists had the idea that myths and rites were an attempt to control nature. Totally wrong. They are not to control nature, they are to control the society and put it in accord with nature. The festival that has to do with the seasonal realm, with the stages of human development, with the stages of the preparation for war and the return from war, getting in touch with the biological ground, with these movements, so one is always in accord. And the economic motive just destroys it all.
Cockerel, I wonder if you could speak a little bit of the tree in the garden, the tree of the cross, the tree of the Buddha's illumination, and how they can be read in a way that opens to an experience of the transcendent.
A few years ago, I saw a tree that was growing on a ravine where the roots, instead of continuing to grow outward, just turned back and went the other way, inward, into the side of the ravine. You can't explain that in sheer mechanistic terms. And what's happening now with the imagery of the evolution of man? The four great stages in the human evolution. Homo faber, Homo erectus, Homo sapiens, Homo sapiens sapiens. Each of those transformations takes place following a maximum movement of the brachial ice, where a whole new environment comes along and there's a sudden adaptation. It happens too fast for the earlier kind of theory to work, you know, the thousands and thousands of years and all that kind of thing. And then there was the time at the end of the Miocene when Africa and Arabia, which had been separated from Europe and Asia by a great sea, moved up, and then the Himalayas rose, whole new environments. Within a few hundred years, there were whole new animal species taking advantage of those environments, and other animals to eat the animals that evolved. It all happens too fast for just the Darwinian thing to work. That doesn't mean that evolution is refuted. It means that the mechanistic way of interpreting it is refuted. And so we're getting back to a kind of Lamarckian view. Lamarck was earlier than Darwin. Then Goethe, in The Metamorphosis of Plants, I think that's where I read it, speaks of the evolution of life. Of course, Goethe was half a century before Darwin came along, and his interpretation was not the Darwinian one of mechanistic interaction, the dynamics from inside the organism that bring about evolution. It's inherent in protoplasm that it should differentiate, evolve. And he speaks of the two great lines of evolution, of the animal and the plant. And the culmination of the animal evolution is the human being, and the culmination of the plant is the tree. And so the tree and the vegetable world represent the undestroyed simplicity and directness of the natural production of a form. A tree is symbolic, you might say, of home. One returns to the nature world that is explicit in the tree. So the garden is the natural realm of the vegetable world, and man is put there as a nature being. His problem is to remain natural while moving into this next stage of high consciousness and differentiated consciousness. He can lose himself in consciousness, but the tree pulls him back. The problem in the biblical tree is that there are two trees there. You're in the garden of timeless being, see, and you're going to move into the realm of time. In the realm of time, everything is dual, is, was, and is to be, past and future. There's you, and there is I. So when you move into the realm of opposites, the tree of the garden is of good and evil, is the gate going out. So they didn't have to be kicked out of the garden by God. They had already kicked themselves out. Their shame and wearing of clothes comes from recognizing male and female are differentiated. To get back to the garden, you have to realize that all is one. You see? One guardian represents the fear of death, and the other, the desire for life. The temptations that didn't touch the Buddha. The Buddha is saying, don't be afraid of those gate guardians. Come in and eat the fruit of the tree.
Joseph Campbell, a Joseph Campbell companion.
So the second tree, the tree of immortal life, is the tree of the return. But the thing about the book of Genesis is that God doesn't want man to return. I mean, this is a peculiar God, a unique God. He doesn't want you to realize that you are immortal. He says, lest man should now eat of the tree of immortal life and become as we are, therefore, let's put him out. There was a very interesting moment in my understanding of these things during the Second World War, when we were at war with Japan. One of the New York newspapers published a photograph of one of the door guardians, the gate guardians in Nara in Japan, right outside Kyoto. And here was this gate guardian. This was the cherub put at the gate of the Garden of Eden. And that guardian stands at the gate to the Buddha sitting under the tree of immortal life. But what it said under there was, the Japanese worship gods like this. Well, they don't. That is a symbol of your own fear and holding to your ego, which is what's keeping you out of the garden, where the Buddha sits under the tree, and his right hand says, "Don't be afraid of those guys, come through." It suddenly dawned on me our God was apparently that guardian at the gate, because he has put the guardians at the gate and told us that they're emphatically there and we mustn't go through. That shifts the whole thing. So our religion is basically a religion of exile. In the Christian tradition, Jesus has, as it were, gone through the gate and eaten of the fruit of the tree and become the tree, which is the crucifixion. That's the sense of the crucifix. Yield. Let it go. Join into your mentality, not this, but the divine immortality, which is in you and in all things. And so Jesus hanging on the cross, which is the second tree in the garden, is equivalent to the Buddha, seated under the tree of immortal life, the Bodhi tree. Bodhi means the one who has waked up to the fact that he is that which he seeks to know, namely the eternal being. The two religions are interesting in that we are told that we are not one with Jesus, but he is to be our model and we're to follow him. But in the Thomas Gospel, Jesus says, "He who drinks from my mouth becomes as I am, and I am he." That's the difference between the Buddhist and the Orthodox Christian view. So we are, again, in exile. You cannot be Jesus, but in the Buddhist religion, you are the Buddha already and just don't know it. I remember hearing a marvelous talk by Daisetsu Suzuki in Ascona, Switzerland. It was, I think, his first talk there at the Uranos Foundation, and here was this group of Europeans in the audience, and there was a Japanese man, he was about 91 years old at the time, a Zen philosopher. He stood with his hands on his side, and he looked at the audience and said, "Nature against God, God against nature, nature against man, man against nature. Man against God, God against man." Very funny religion.
Joseph Campbell, Mythos.
Now, I was lecturing on this point in saying that for the Christian, one should live in terms of the Christ in you. And a woman came up to me some weeks later and said that she was sitting next to a priest, and he said, "That's blasphemy." Well, if that's blasphemy, what in heaven's name are we talking about? I remember when I was a kid in school, when I was reciting catechism. Why did God make you? God made me to love him, to serve him, and to honor him in this world, and be happy with him forever in heaven. That has to do with a relationship to God. God did not make me to realize my godhood. There was a lovely young woman who was a nun, and is now no longer a nun because she heard me lecture once. After one of my talks, she came up to me and said, "Do you believe that Jesus Christ was the Son of God?" And I said, "Not unless all of us are." That's the difference. Do you see what I mean? If you specialize the revelation, then you've removed the humanity from it. And insofar as that specialization takes place, you have removed yourself from the human race. This is a terrible thing, I would personally think, to insist on these special revelations. This is a reactionary system, and it's antithetical to the dynamics of time. It's bad stuff, particularly at the present moment when all the special traditions of the world are coming into collision and are transforming. The globe is our homeland. The divine lives of saviors are symbolic of the meaning of the Savior's teaching. It is not like Carl Sandburg's Life of Lincoln, where you get documentation of the actual details of the life. It has nothing to do with what happened in life. It has to do with the implications of the life. The Buddha lived from 563 to 483 BC. The first life of the Buddha was written in 80 BC in Ceylon. We don't know anything about the Buddha. We don't know anything about Christ. We don't know anything about Zoroaster. All we know are the legends which tell you what the meaning of their lives is, you see? And what the Buddha said, and what Christ said. I mean, read the four Gospels and then read the fifth. Read the Gospel according to Thomas. And what was he saying? Who wants to be remembered by the notes of his students? The idea of the Bodhisattva is the one who, out of his realization of transcendence, participates in the world. The imitation of Christ is joyful participation in the sorrows of the world.
Joseph Campbell, Mythos. Chapter 7, The Return Threshold.
How to teach again what has been taught correctly and incorrectly 1,000 times throughout the millenniums of mankind's prudent folly? That is the hero's ultimate difficult task. How to render it back into light world language, the speech-defying pronouncements of the dark? Many failures attest to the difficulties of this life-affirmative threshold.
Joseph Campbell, The Hero with 1,000 Faces. Joseph Campbell became a much sought-after lecturer on college campuses and human potential institutes around the United States in the 1970s and 1980s. Many accomplished artists and scholars publicly expressed their admiration of his work. At symposiums in New York and San Francisco to celebrate his 80th birthday and the theme of the hero's journey, sculptor Isamu Noguchi, choreographer Martha Graham, author Richard Adams, poet Robert Bly, anthropologists Barbara Meyerhoff and Maria Gimbutas, and many others expressed their gratitude for his awakening of the mythological dimension in their lives and work. But it was in the movies that Campbell's cultural impact gained its greatest notoriety. No book has come close to influencing contemporary movies as pervasively as Joseph Campbell's The Hero with 1,000 Faces, wrote film critic Michael Ventura. Filmmakers such as Steven Spielberg, George Miller, and George Lucas all credited Campbell with inspiration for the mythic underpinnings in their stories. In February 1985, Lucas joined Adams, writer Nancy Willard, and psychologist James Hillman at the National Arts Club in New York when Campbell was awarded its Medal of Honor for Literature. The following year, at the age of 82, Campbell was invited by the Grateful Dead to attend his first rock and roll concert. "To think that my work has been influential to people like George Lucas and the Grateful Dead," he told reporters in 1986, "I'm absolutely delighted."
"I guess this is the big moment of my life, winning the Medal of Honor for Literature. I knew that I had found something when I started writing The Hero. It came up very slowly. I worked about 5 or 6 years on it. It came out of my course that I was giving in comparative mythology to my students at Sarah Lawrence College. Now, it was Euripides who said, 'The myth is not my own, I have it from my mother.' And I think I can say, 'The myth is not my own, I got it from my students.' Because they were all young women, and they were not interested at all in just who wrote the myth and what the date was. They wanted to know what it meant to them, what it could mean to the children they were going to have. And then to hear, as I have heard tonight from these really majestic artists that we have had the wonderful privilege of hearing speak, and to hear my name in relation to their work makes it difficult to stand up and talk. It has been a large, large experience, because that's what I was hoping for when I was writing, namely that I was giving people the key to the realm of the muses, which is where myth is. It delights me particularly to receive the award from the Arts Club and to receive it for literature and not from some scientific society or scholarly community, because to think that my contribution has been in the way of literature instead of scholarship is a marvelous promotion. I remember Alan Watts asked me one day, 'Joe, what kind of meditation do you do?' I said, 'I underline sentences.' Now, there is a beautiful phrase that I ran into in Novalis. The seat of the soul is there where the inner and the outer worlds meet. The outer world is what you get in scholarship. The inner world is your response to it. And it is there where these come together that we have the myths. The outer world changes with historical time. The inner world is the world of Anthropos. The mythological systems are a constant, and what you are recognizing is your own inward life, and at the same time the inflection to history. The problem of making the inner meet the outer of today is, of course, the function of the artist. To think that my work has had some influence on people who are doing this is why I feel so proud of this moment. The other experience, of course, was being married to an artist, Jean, a dancer. And to see an artist manipulating these wonderful things, turning them into dances, and then into that wonderful play, The Coach, with the six insides. In 1962, it first appeared based on Finnegan's Wake, and we had 3 or 4 years of quite vivid experiences in Italy and Paris, and so forth and so on. And then her later plays. This participation is from a distance. I'm the one who sees it for the first time, and I say, oh, they're just talking too fast, and I can't hear. That's about the extent of my criticism and contribution to these things. But that's also helped me to stay with this mythological world in relation to creative life. I can't tell you how grateful I am for this event. It lets me know, in spite of my non-academic career, you might say, I must have been doing something right to have influenced the people such as I have been meeting and hearing tonight. I can't tell you how deeply moved I've been by what I've heard from these beautiful people who have spoken in my name. It is a culminating moment in my life.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are here this evening in honor of Joseph Campbell. And I say in honor, and not to honor him, for that has been accomplished by his work, its massive and sufficient scholarship, its conviction, and its delightful fascination, and by what his life of dedication has given to our culture, the deepening of its soul into myth. And this gift to our culture and its soul continues to honor him throughout America, in bookstores and classrooms, in movie theaters and in therapists' offices, in the imagination of writers and dreamers. No one in our century, not Freud, not Thomas Mann or Levi Strauss, has so brought the mythical sense of the world and its eternal figures back into our everyday consciousness. In his own words, to see the continued romance of Beauty and the Beast, stand this afternoon on the corner of 42nd Street and 5th Avenue waiting for the light to change. The myths are in our daily lives. What is not on your program is the passion which underlies the accomplishment. This passion as desire, together with the painstaking care desire always imposes, can be condensed in Joseph Campbell's maxim for how to be, how to live on this earth. The maxim can be traced to a life involving the gods, the goddesses, the heroes, the animals, the little people, and the daimones that aid you in following your bliss forever. James Hillman, National Arts Club, 1985. A kind of chain reaction comes from his discoveries that have reverberated out into writing novels, into psychiatry, into anthropology, into mythology, into filmmaking, into creative work, and apart from all that, he's a damn nice guy. It's hard to believe that Shakespeare didn't read Joseph Campbell. Richard Adams, National Arts Club, 1985. Cockrell. What I would like to do is have an Upanishadic conversation, a sitting close in. Artists have always, as in the Renaissance, had a great deal to do with establishing the strength and the interpretation of Christianity. Do you think that contemporary artists could, through their powers, reinterpret our current symbols?
What happened in the Renaissance is fascinating. Cosimo de' Medici received a manuscript from Macedonia that was brought by a Greek monk. It was a manuscript of the Corpus Hermeticum, which was a body of late classical text about the sense of the symbology of the classical world, which was exactly contemporary with the formative period of Christianity, the first 2 centuries. This text was translated by Marsilio Ficino, and immediately it was realized that the symbology of the Christian faith and the symbology of the late classical myths were saying the same thing. That's what inspired Renaissance art. Botticelli is full of it, and Michelangelo and the whole lot of them. This gave a new vitality to the Christian imagery itself, because they understood its spiritual sense, not its historical reference, do you see? The reference is not to something that happened which has released us from sin. It didn't release us from sin. What the crucifixion did was give a model so you could release yourself from it. And that's the whole difference. This is the big inspiration of Renaissance art. In one of those cockeyed theaters that are in New York on 42nd and Broadway, I saw advertised Fire Women from Outer Space. That was a mythological idea. In Tibetan Buddhism, these are called Dokelis, fire women from outer space. And in their spiritual powers, they can excite you a little bit. And so I thought, well, we're getting back to the old days in a very funny way. Whenever the human imagination gets going, it has to work in the fields that myths have already covered, and it renders them in new ways, that's all.
Joseph Campbell, Esalen, 1982.
Now, the problem of the contemporary artists would be to recognize in the conditions of contemporary life the possibility of transparency to transcendence through those conditions. The artist's function is to render the forms of the world in which we live and the social actions that we engage in, render them transparent to the transcendent, turn them into transparencies.
Cockerell. As Joyce says, any object properly regarded can be the gateway to the gods. So when you look at Cézanne's apple, I'll put it your way, you don't want to eat Cézanne's apple because they hold you in what Joyce called aesthetic arrest.
That's right. That's in Ulysses, in the maternity hospital chapter.
Cockerell, if you had the opportunity to speak to the artists of the world and point them in the right direction about what to do with the bodies of mythology that we have, what would you say to them?
I'd say, buy a copy of The Hero with a Thousand Faces. And I'd say, look at things not as them being the things in themselves, but as manifestations of a mystery. The idea of a mystery is what it's all about, and that mystery of these things is your mystery. Somebody once said to me, just think of a thing as a thou instead of an it, and then our experience changes.
Brown. One of the areas that's been of interest to those of us who know you and have watched things happen in the last couple of years has been your involvement with George Lucas and the themes of man versus machine.
One of the big delights and surprising delights has been to find how my books have helped other people. In the arts, in the dance, for instance, Martha Graham's work, in Jean's work, and in Merce Cunningham's early work and so forth, these mythic themes are the realm of the muses. It's not that I tell people what to do, but my work points out where the inspiration is. And you move in yourself as an artist and pull it out. So lately I've learned that Richard Adams, with his Watership Down, came over to see me to thank me for what I had given him in the way of The Hero with a Thousand Faces. And then suddenly George Lucas with Star Wars. Now, of course, I hadn't seen a movie in years. I mean, when you're reading and reading, you can't have time to do all the things you'd like to do. Movies dropped out of my life a long, long time ago. Besides, when I was in Europe, a terrible change had taken place. When I left this country, we had only black and white, silent movies. There was a wonderful art developing then of mime and all of that. I come back and you have talkies. I never really caught on to the talkie as an interesting art. Too naturalistic, you know. Naturalism is the death of the art. And that's one of the big problems in our American arts, I think. They don't understand the metaphor. It's all naturalism.
About 10 years ago, I set out to write a children's film, and I had an idea of doing a modern fairy tale. My friends all around said, "What are you doing? You're crazy. You have to do something important. You have to do something that is socially relevant. You have to do something that is art with a capital A. You have to do what we're doing." I had been working on a project about Vietnam, Apocalypse Now, and I had abandoned it, gave it to a friend of mine, Francis Coppola, and said, "I've got to do this children's film." I didn't know what I was doing at the time. I started working, started doing research, started writing, and a year went by. I wrote many drafts of this work, and then I stumbled across The Hero with a Thousand Faces. It was the first time that I really began to focus. Once I read that book, I said to myself, "This is what I've been doing. This is it." I had been reading other doctors, Freudians,